A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel sent us this one. He's home alone with Ezra for one of the longest stretches yet, and it's going about how you'd expect. Diaper incident, impromptu bath, the classic first time you're truly alone with the baby spiral where you realize the instruction manual doesn't exist, and he's asking us to build one. Two folders of SOPs, standard operating procedures, one for routine childcare, one for first aid and medical. The real question underneath it is, for someone with an ADHD brain who uses documentation as an anchor against overwhelm, what does a good system actually look like?
This is the exact right question to ask. And I'll say up front, as a retired pediatrician, the fact that he's asking it after a hard day instead of just white-knuckling through is a very good sign.
Where do we even start with this? Because I can already hear the internet groaning. SOPs for parenting. It sounds like the most Herman Poppleberry thing ever conceived.
I'll take that as a compliment. But here's the thing. Most parents hit a moment like this. The difference is whether you build a system after the breakdown or just promise yourself you'll do better next time. Daniel's instinct to externalize the thinking, to get it out of his head and onto something he can reference when he's tired or stressed. That's not weird, that's evidence-based. There's a whole body of research on cognitive offloading. When you're in the thick of it with a screaming infant, your working memory is shot. You can't hold the decision tree in your head.
The folder isn't the weird part. The weird part is admitting you need it.
And I want to frame both folders before we dive into the specifics. The routine care folder, that's your operational backbone. The stuff that happens every day, multiple times a day. Feeding, diapering, sleep, bath, play. The medical folder is your emergency response system. You hope you never open it, but when you need it fast, and you need it clear. They serve completely different cognitive functions.
One is the daily rhythm. The other is the fire extinguisher.
They should be built differently. Let's start with the routine care folder, because that's where most of the actual living happens. For an ADHD brain specifically, the enemy is ambiguity. If a step says change the diaper, that's already too vague. Change it where? What do you do with the old one? What if there's a rash? The SOP needs to answer the questions your brain will generate in the moment, because in the moment you won't have the bandwidth to figure it out.
You're saying the SOP should be written for the version of you that's running on 4 hours of sleep and hasn't eaten since yesterday.
That's exactly the persona you're writing for. Not your best self, your most depleted self. And I'd argue the routine care folder should contain, at minimum, 6 SOPs.
Let's hear them.
Number 1, the morning startup sequence. This covers wake up, first diaper change, first feed, and getting dressed. It should include a pre-flight check. Do you have enough diapers for the day? Is the diaper bag stocked if you're going out? Are the bottles clean? Number 2, the feeding SOP. This might need sub-variants depending on whether the child is breastfed, formula-fed, or doing solids. But the core structure is the same. Preparation, feeding position, burping, cleanup, and logging. For an ADHD parent, tracking is everything. When did the last feed happen? How much did they take? When's the next one due? You can use an app or a whiteboard on the fridge, but it has to exist outside your head. I've seen parents spiral because they couldn't remember if the baby ate 40 minutes ago or 2 hours ago, and that uncertainty feeds the overwhelm.
The whiteboard is the external hard drive for a brain that keeps dropping the connection.
Number 3, the diaper change SOP. And I'm serious about this being its own document. It sounds trivial until you're dealing with a blowout and you realize you don't have wipes within arm's reach and the baby's kicking and you're about to make everything worse. The SOP should specify, gather supplies first, check, don't skip the supply check, position the child safely, the actual change procedure, disposal, hand hygiene, and then a post-change check for rash or irritation. Number 4, the sleep routine. SOP, this covers both nap time and bedtime. Wind down sequence, environment check, dark room, white noise, temperature, the actual putting down technique, and then what to do if the baby won't settle.
What to do if the baby won't settle feels like it could be its own library.
It could, but the SOP should give you a decision tree, not an encyclopedia. Try this, wait 5 minutes, if no improvement. Try this, if still no improvement after 15 minutes, try this. The point is to prevent the frantic Googling at 2 in the morning.
The frantic Googling at 2 in the morning is basically the national sport of new parenthood.
That's what we're trying to replace with a single laminated sheet. Number 5, the bath, SOP. Daniel mentioned an impromptu bath after a diaper incident. An SOP would turn that from a crisis into a procedure. Water temperature check, and I mean a specific temperature, not warm but not too hot. The CDC recommends checking with your wrist or elbow. The water should feel warm, not hot. Gather towel, clean diaper, clean clothes before you start. Never leave the child unattended, not even for a second. The bath itself, drying, dressing, and then a post-bath check for any skin issues.
What's number 6?
The evening shutdown sequence. This is the counterpart to the morning startup. It covers the last feed, last diaper change, changing into sleep clothes, the bedtime wind down, and then the parent side checklist. Restock the changing station for overnight, prep bottles for the next feed, set out clothes for the morning. The shutdown sequence is about setting future you up for success.
This is the close the kitchen ritual from your restaurant days, applied to infant care.
And number 7, which is optional but I'd strongly recommend for an ADHD brain, the go bag SOP. What goes in the diaper bag every time you leave the house? Because pack the diaper bag is a task that can eat 30 minutes of indecision if you don't have a list. Diapers. How many? Wipes, changing pad, spare outfit, bottles or snacks, burp cloth, pacifier, a small toy, hand sanitizer. The list lives in the bag or on the bag. You check it before you leave, every time.
We've got 7 SOPs for the routine folder. And I want to push on something here. You mentioned lamination earlier. Are we actually laminating these?
I'm serious about physical copies. Digital is great as a backup, but when you're mid-crisis with a screaming baby, you don't want to unlock your phone, find the right app, scroll to the right document. A laminated sheet on the changing table, on the fridge, on the bathroom door, that's instant access. And lamination means it survives spills, which in this context is not a hypothetical.
The lamination is doing a lot of heavy lifting here. It's the difference between a system you maintain and a system that maintains itself.
For an ADHD brain, a system that requires maintenance is a system that will fail within 2 weeks. The lamination is the commitment device. Now, the second folder, first aid and medical, this is where the structure changes completely. These aren't daily procedures. These are decision trees for when something goes wrong. And the most important thing about a decision tree is that it has a clear escalation point.
Define escalation point.
The line in the tree where you stop trying to handle it yourself and call the doctor or go to the emergency room. Every single medical SOP needs an unambiguous red line. If you see X, stop this procedure and call the pediatrician immediately. No judgment calls, no use your best discretion. When you're scared and your child is hurt or sick, your judgment is compromised. The tree does the thinking for you.
What belongs in the medical folder?
I'd structure it around the most common incidents and the most common parental panics. Number 1, the fever, SOP. This is probably the single most anxiety-producing symptom for parents of infants. For a child under 3 months, any rectal temperature of 100.4 Fahrenheit or higher, 38 Celsius, is an automatic call to the doctor or a trip to the emergency room. That's the hard red line. For an 11-month-old like Ezra, the threshold is different. You're looking at the height of the fever, the duration, and the child's behavior. If the fever hits 104 Fahrenheit, 40 Celsius, call the doctor. If it lasts more than 3 days, call the doctor. But equally important, if the child is lethargic, inconsolable, or showing signs of dehydration, call regardless of the number on the thermometer.
The number isn't the only variable.
The number is one data point. The child's overall state is the other. The SOP should walk through, take temperature with the appropriate method. For infants, rectal is the gold standard. Record the reading and the time, assess behavior, check for other symptoms, and then follow the tree. If the fever is below the threshold and the child is alert and hydrated, the SOP guides you through home management, appropriate dosing of acetaminophen or ibuprofen. And I want to stress, dosing is by weight, not age, and you need to know the concentration of the medication you have. Light clothing, offer fluids frequently, monitor.
The medication dosing part feels like it should be its own separate document.
That's SOP number 2 in the medical folder, the medication administration SOP. It should list, for each medication you keep in the house, the active ingredient, the concentration, the weight-based dosing formula, the maximum daily dose, and the minimum interval between doses. Acetaminophen and ibuprofen are the big two for an 11-month-old. This SOP needs to be updated as the child grows. A dosing chart that was correct at 15 pounds is dangerous at 25 pounds.
That's a maintenance burden.
It is, and that's why I'd put a recurring calendar reminder on this one. First of every month, weigh the child, update the dosing chart. It takes 5 minutes. It's the kind of thing an ADHD brain will forget exists until the moment it's needed, and then you're doing frantic math at 3 a.m. with a feverish child.
The calendar reminder is the external conscience.
SOP number 3, the breathing difficulty decision tree. This covers everything from a stuffy nose to signs of respiratory distress. The red lines here, if the child is breathing fast, for an infant, more than about 60 breaths per minute, if you see retractions, where the skin between the ribs or above the collarbone sucks in with each breath, if there's nasal flaring, if the lips or face look blue or dusky, if there's a barking cough that sounds like a seal, that's croup, or if there's wheezing. Any of these, you're escalating. For milder stuff, the SOP guides you through nasal suction with a bulb syringe or a nose. Frida, using a cool mist humidifier, keeping the child upright, offering fluids.
What about choking? That feels like it needs its own thing.
That's SOP number 4, and it's different in structure. Choking is a time-critical emergency. You don't have time to read a decision tree. So the choking SOP is a procedure, not a tree. It's a sequence of actions you memorize by reviewing the document regularly. For an infant under 1 year, it's back blows and chest thrusts, 5 of each, alternating, checking after each cycle. The SOP should have clear diagrams or very explicit descriptions. And the red line is, if the child becomes unresponsive, start CPR and call emergency services immediately. This is the one SOP I'd recommend parents physically practice, not just read.
Practice on a doll, or...
There are infant CPR mannequins you can get, or you can take an infant first aid course, which I'd recommend regardless of the SOPs. The SOP is the reference, not the training. SOP number 5, the allergic reaction decision tree. Mild symptoms, a few hives, some redness around the mouth. You can monitor at home, maybe given age, appropriate antihistamine if your pediatrician has approved one. But the red lines for anaphylaxis, difficulty breathing, swelling of the lips or tongue or throat, widespread hives, vomiting, pale or blue skin, weak pulse, seeming confused or losing consciousness. Any one of these, and you're using an epinephrine auto-injector if you have one, and calling emergency services. Do not wait. Do not drive to the hospital yourself. Call an ambulance. Anaphylaxis can escalate in minutes.
That's a hard red line.
SOP number 6, the vomiting and diarrhea decision tree. The primary concern here, especially for infants, is dehydration. The SOP should help you assess. How many wet diapers in the last 8 hours, fewer than 3 or 4, is a warning sign. Is the mouth dry? Are there tears when crying? Is the soft spot on the head sunken? Is the child unusually sleepy or irritable? For management at home, offer small amounts of fluid frequently. Consider an oral rehydration solution like Pedialyte. Avoid sugary drinks and watch for the warning signs. The red line, if the child can't keep any fluids down for more than a few hours, if there's blood in the vomit or stool, if there are signs of moderate to severe dehydration, if the vomiting is forceful or projectile, or if there's severe abdominal pain.
How many SOPs are we at for the medical folder?
I'm at 6, and I'd add 2 more. Number 7, the falls and head injuries decision tree. It's what they do. The SOP helps you distinguish between a bump that needs a kiss and a cold pack and something that needs a CT scan. Red lines, loss of consciousness, even briefly, vomiting after a head injury, seizure, clear fluid, or blood coming from the nose or ears, unequal pupil size, weakness on one side, unusual sleepiness or difficulty waking, persistent crying or irritability, or if the fall was from a height greater than the child's standing height. For minor bumps, apply a cold pack wrapped in a cloth, monitor closely for the next 24 hours, wake the child every 2 to 3 hours during sleep to check responsiveness if the injury was more than trivial.
Wake them every 2 to 3 hours. That's a rough night for the parents.
It is, but it's the standard precaution for a reason. And SOP number 8, the cuts, burns, and rashes decision tree. This is your catch-all for skin issues. For cuts, clean with water, apply pressure to stop bleeding, assess depth and length. Red line, if the cut is deep, gaping, won't stop bleeding after 10 minutes of pressure or is on the face or a joint. You're going to the doctor, it may need stitches or glue. For burns, cool the area under cool, not cold. Running water for at least 10 minutes, don't apply ice, don't apply butter or oil or any of the folk remedies, cover loosely with a clean cloth or non-stick bandage. Red line, any burn that blisters, any burn larger than the child's palm, any burn on the face, hands, feet, or genitals. Doctor. For rashes, the SOP helps you distinguish between diaper rash, heat rash, eczema, and something that needs a doctor's eyes. Red lines, rash with fever, rash that looks like tiny red pinpricks that don't fade when you press a glass against them. That's the glass test for meningitis, or any rash that's spreading rapidly or blistering.
That's 8 SOPs for the medical folder, 7 for the routine folder. We're at 15 documents. Is this realistic for someone with ADHD to actually build and maintain?
That's the right question. And the answer is, not if you try to build them all at once. The all-or-nothing approach is the enemy of the ADHD brain. You get overwhelmed by the scope, you do nothing, and then you feel worse. The way to build this is incremental. Start with the 3 that would have helped most in the last crisis. For Daniel, based on what he described, I'd say the diaper change, SOP, the bath SOP, and the fever decision tree. Build those 3 this week. Then add 1 per week.
The 1 per week pace also gives you time to notice what's actually useful versus what looked good on paper.
And the format matters enormously. For an ADHD parent, the ideal SOP format has 3 characteristics. First, it's visual. Color coding, icons, clear section headers. You want to be able to find the information without reading. Second, it's scannable. Bullet points, not paragraphs. Decision trees should be actual flowcharts with arrows. Third, it's physically located where the task happens. The diaper SOP lives at the changing station. The bath SOP lives in the bathroom. The fever SOP lives in the medicine cabinet or wherever you keep the thermometer.
This is the anti-binder philosophy. Instead of one big binder you never open, you have single sheets posted at the point of use.
The binder is where SOPs go to die. I've seen it in hospitals, I've seen it in homes. If you have to walk to another room to get the reference, you won't. You'll wing it. And winging it is fine when things are going well. It's when things aren't going well that you need the document.
What about the actual writing process? I think a lot of people, especially ADHD brains, would get stuck on, how do I write an SOP? What's the format?
I'd keep it dead simple. Title at the top. Purpose, one sentence, what this SOP is for. Supplies needed, listed with checkboxes. Then the procedure, numbered steps, each step one action. No and in a step. If a step has and, it's 2 steps. Then the decision tree, if applicable. Then the escalation point in bold or red. That's it. The whole thing should fit on one page. If it doesn't fit on one page, it's too long and you need to split it into 2 SOPs.
One page, one procedure, one location. The atomic SOP.
And I want to talk about something that often gets missed, the maintenance system. The SOPs aren't write once and forget. The child grows, the procedures change, the medication dosing changes, the feeding schedule changes. So you need a review rhythm. For the routine SOPs, I do a quick review once a month. Does this still reflect reality? For the medical SOPs, every 3 months or whenever there's a well child visit. The pediatrician can sanity check your decision trees.
The meta SOP, the SOP for maintaining the SOPs.
That SOP is set a recurring calendar event. First Saturday of the month, review routine SOPs. First Saturday of the quarter, review medical SOPs. It takes 15 minutes. The calendar event is the thing that makes the whole system work because it externalizes the trigger. You don't have to remember to review. The calendar remembers.
Far we've been talking about the content and the format. I want to zoom out for a second. What's the failure mode here? What makes a system like this collapse?
1. The system is too ambitious up front. You try to build 15 SOPs in a weekend, you burn out, you associate the whole thing with failure, and you never look at it again. 2. The SOPs are too long or too dense. If it takes more than 10 seconds to find the information you need, it might as well not exist. 3. And this is the subtle one. The SOPs become a substitute for paying attention. You follow the procedure mechanically and miss that your child is acting off in a way the SOP doesn't capture. The SOP is a safety net, not an autopilot.
That third one feels important. There's a version of this where the documentation becomes a way to disengage from the actual child.
That's a real risk, especially for someone whose instinct under stress is to retreat into systems and processes. The SOP should be something you glance at to confirm or to guide, not something you read while your child is crying. The child comes first. The document is the backup. If you find yourself reading the diaper SOP every single time you change a diaper after the first week, something's wrong. You're using it as a crutch, not a reference.
The goal is for the SOPs to eventually become background knowledge. You internalize them, and the physical copy is there for the bad days.
For the routine SOPs, yes. The medical SOPs are different. You hope you never need them enough to internalize them. They exist for the one time in 2 years, when your child has a febrile seizure, and you can't remember whether you're supposed to hold them down or clear the area and time it. For the record, clear the area, don't restrain, time the seizure, call emergency services if it lasts more than 5 minutes.
You just gave a piece of the seizure SOP from memory.
Pediatrician for 30 years. Some things stick. But most parents don't have that background, and they shouldn't be expected to. That's the whole point of the folder.
Let's talk about the decision tree format specifically, because I think that's where the most value is, and also where the most can go wrong. What makes a good decision tree versus a bad one?
A good decision tree starts with a single, clear question. Does the child have a fever? Yes or no? If yes, what is the temperature? And then branches based on ranges. Each node should be a yes or no question or a choice between clearly distinct options. The branches lead either to an action, give acetaminophen, dose X, or to another question, or to an escalation point. A bad decision tree has fuzzy questions. Is the child acting sick? What does that mean? A good tree operationalizes acting sick into observable behaviors. Is the child making eye contact? Is the child smiling when smiled at? Is the child consolable when held?
Break the vague judgment into observable checkpoints.
And the tree should be designed so that the most dangerous path is the first thing you check. In the fever tree, the first question isn't, what's the temperature? It's, is the child under 3 months? Because if yes, the temperature almost doesn't matter. You're going to the doctor regardless. The tree routes you to safety first, then to nuance.
That's a design principle. Worst case first.
It's counterintuitive, because most people want to start with the mild stuff and work up. But in a medical decision tree, you rule out the emergencies first, because missing them is catastrophic. Once you've ruled out the red flags, you can relax into the home management branch.
I want to circle back to something you mentioned earlier about equipment and supplies. The SOPs reference things like thermometers, nasal aspirators, medication syringes. Should there be a master inventory list somewhere?
And that's a separate document, the home medical kit inventory. It lives with the medical SOPs, and it lists everything you should have on hand, digital thermometer. And I recommend having two, because they have a way of disappearing. Medication syringes or droppers in multiple sizes, acetaminophen and ibuprofen in the correct concentration for the child's weight, an antihistamine if approved by your pediatrician, bandages in various sizes, sterile gauze, medical tape, antiseptic wipes or spray, a cold pack, a bulb syringe or nasal aspirator, petroleum jelly, diaper rash cream, sunscreen, insect bite treatment, an emergency contact list with the pediatrician's number, the nearest emergency room, and poison control. And, if the child has any known allergies, an epinephrine auto-injector with clear instructions.
The inventory should have expiration dates.
The inventory should include expiration dates, and there should be a recurring calendar reminder to check and replace. Every 3 months is reasonable. Nothing worse than reaching for the ibuprofen at 2 in the morning and finding it expired 6 months ago.
That's the kind of detail that separates a system that works from a system that's a cosplay of organization.
The cosplay of organization. I'm going to use that. And it's true, a lot of parenting systems are really about feeling in control, not actually being prepared. The laminated sheet with checkboxes that nobody ever checks. The difference is whether the system meets you where you actually are, in your actual life, with your actual brain.
Speaking of which, we've been talking about ADHD as a reason to build these systems, but I think there's something universal here. Even a neurotypical parent, whatever that means, is going to be sleep-deprived and overwhelmed at some point. The system is for the worst version of yourself, regardless of your baseline.
The ADHD framing is useful because it forces you to design for cognitive limitations that everyone experiences under stress. The sleep-deprived parent of a newborn has the working memory of someone with severe ADHD, regardless of their usual neurology. So these design principles, externalize, simplify, make it visual, put it at the point of use, build in escalation points. Those help everyone.
The ADHD-friendly system is actually just a good system, full stop.
The best systems are designed for the hardest use case. If it works for someone with executive function challenges at 3 in the morning, it works for anyone.
Let's talk about the emotional side of this for a minute. Daniel mentioned having a breakdown, the kind where you realize how much you don't know. And I think there's something about building these SOPs that's not just practical, it's psychological. It's a way of saying, I'm not going to be caught off guard like that again.
There's a term for this in trauma-informed care, mastery, and control. After a frightening experience, rebuilding a sense of competence is part of the recovery. The SOPs aren't just procedures. They're a way of processing what went wrong and asserting that you can handle it next time. That's not neurotic. That's healthy coping.
It's the difference between, I'm a bad parent because I didn't know what to do, and I didn't know what to do because nobody taught me, and now I'm going to teach myself.
And I want to say this clearly because I think a lot of parents, fathers especially, feel shame in moments like this. The shame of not knowing. The shame of needing a checklist for something that's supposed to be natural. Let me tell you, as someone who spent decades in pediatrics, parenting is not natural in the sense of being instinctual. It's a set of skills. Skills can be learned, skills can be documented, skills can be practiced. There's no shame in using a tool to do a job well.
The checklist isn't an admission of failure. It's an admission that you take the job seriously.
And I'd argue that building these SOPs is actually an act of care. It's saying, I care enough about my child's well-being to think through the worst-case scenarios in advance when I'm calm and rested, so that I don't have to figure it out in a panic.
All right, let's get concrete about the implementation. Daniel's got an 11-month-old. What's the highest priority SOP in each folder for where Ezra is developmentally right now?
At 11 months, mobility is the game changer. Ezra is probably crawling, maybe cruising, possibly on the verge of walking. That means falls, choking, and household hazards become much more relevant than they were at 3 months. So in the medical folder, I'd prioritize the choking SOP and the falls and head injuries, SOP. Those are the incidents most likely to happen in the next 3 months. In the routine folder, the feeding SOP probably needs updating because at 11 months you're introducing more solids, and the sleep SOP may need adjustment if there's a sleep regression, which is common around this age.
The sleep regression at 9 to 10 months is a real thing.
And an SOP won't prevent a sleep regression, but it can prevent the parental spiral of, nothing is working and I don't know what to try next. The SOP gives you a sequence of interventions to cycle through, which keeps you moving instead of freezing.
I want to ask about the spouse factor. These SOPs don't exist in a vacuum. If Hannah has a different approach to something, or if she's the one who usually handles certain tasks, how does the documentation account for that?
That's a crucial point. The SOPs need to reflect the household's actual practices, not just one parent's preferences. The process of writing them should be collaborative. Sit down together, walk through each procedure, and agree on the standard. That conversation itself is valuable. It surfaces assumptions and discrepancies. Oh, you use the forehead thermometer? I've been using the rectal one. You put the diaper cream on before the rash appears. I've been waiting until it's red. Those discrepancies matter, especially when you're handing off care.
The SOP negotiation is a relationship exercise disguised as a productivity project.
It really is. And if you can't agree on a standard, that's useful information too. Some things don't need to be standardized. But for safety-critical procedures, medication dosing, choking response, fever management, you need alignment. Those aren't matters of preference.
What about digital versus physical? We talked about laminated sheets, but Daniel's a tech person. Is there a case for an app or a shared digital document?
I do both. The physical copies are for immediate access in an emergency. The digital copies are for updating, sharing, and backing up. A shared note in whatever app the household uses. Notion, Apple Notes, Google Docs, that's the source of truth. You edit it there, then print and laminate the current version for the point of use. If you only have digital, you're one dead phone battery away from being without your references. If you only have physical, the updating process is a pain and it won't happen.
The hybrid model, digital for maintenance, physical for deployment.
I'll add one more layer, photos and videos. For things like how to use the nasal aspirator or what does the correct car seat buckle look like, a 30-second video on your phone is worth 1,000 words. Link to those videos from the digital version of the SOP.
That's smart. The SOP as a hub that points to other resources, not a document that tries to contain everything.
The SOP is the index. It tells you what to do and where to find the details if you need them. See video for car seat strap positioning. See dosing chart on fridge for current weight. The SOP itself stays lean.
We've been talking about Ezra as a baby, but these systems evolve. What does the SOP library look like for a 3-year-old? A 7-year-old?
The routine SOPs change the most. Feeding evolves dramatically. Sleep routines change. You add SOPs for things like potty training, which is its own entire project. The medical SOPs evolve more slowly. The decision trees for fever and allergic reactions stay structurally similar, but the dosing changes, the red line thresholds adjust. By the time the child is school age, you're adding SOPs for things like morning routine for school days and what to pack for lunch and after-school pickup procedure. The system grows with the child.
At some point, the child starts participating in the SOPs.
That's the long game. A 7-year-old can follow a morning routine checklist. A 10-year-old can help write the checklist. You're not just managing care, you're teaching executive function skills.
The SOPs become a parenting tool in both directions. They help you manage the child, and they help the child learn to manage themselves.
That's the vision. And it starts with a father having a rough day and deciding he doesn't want to feel that unprepared again.
We should probably summarize the two folders concretely for anyone who wants to build this themselves. Routine care folder, morning startup, feeding, diaper change, sleep routine, bath, evening shutdown, go bag. Medical folder, fever, medication administration, breathing difficulty, choking, allergic reaction, vomiting and diarrhea, falls and head injuries, cuts, burns, and rashes. Plus the medical kit inventory as a supporting document. And the SOP for maintenance.
That's the scaffold. Start with 3, add 1 per week, review monthly and quarterly. Laminate the physical copies. Keep digital source of truth. Put the sheets where the task happens. Design for the most depleted version of yourself. And remember that the goal is not to follow procedures mechanically, it's to free up mental bandwidth so you can actually be present with your child.
The SOPs aren't a replacement for attention. They're the thing that makes attention possible.
That's it exactly.
Now, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
In the late 1600s, a French missionary on the shores of Lake Tanganyika reportedly built a rudimentary electrical signaling device out of clay jars, copper strips scavenged from a trading vessel, and vinegar made from fermented bananas, using it to alert nearby villages of approaching slave raiders up to 2 miles away. The device worked on a basic voltaic principle nearly a century before Volta was born, but the missionary's notes were lost in a monastery fire and the design was never replicated.
A century before Volta, on Lake Tanganyika, with banana vinegar.
Sometimes history just leaves a single voicemail and hangs up.
This has been My Weird Prompts. Our producer is Hilbert Flemingtop. If you found this useful, we'd appreciate a review wherever you listen. It helps other people find the show. Until next time.
Don't laminate anything you haven't tested first.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The host dig in, the host dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time. stay curious, keep weird in mind.